This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
So, Senator Harris, Mr. Harris, what would you prefer that I call you?
Either way, it's whatever Senator Harris, I suppose. But a former senator asked me after I started teaching at the university, what do your students call you? And I said, what do you mean? They call you professor or senator? And I had to think a minute. And I said, most of them call me Fred.
Fred Harris is a former senator from Oklahoma, a two-time presidential candidate, and a professor of political science. He's 90 this year, and he's the last surviving member of the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders. Lyndon Johnson had assembled the commission to look into the causes of an uprising in Detroit in 1967.
Offices, banks, schools, businesses, industry were closed down. The heart of Detroit was deserted. Deliveries were curtailed. Food ran short. All normal activities in the nation's fifth largest city were at a standstill.
The commission's findings were stark. In a document known as the Kerner Report, they said that America was moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. This was not at all what President Johnson wanted to hear, and he refused to meet with his own commission to discuss the report. A concise version has been republished and edited with an introduction by staff writer Jelani Cobb.
The original Kerner report was huge. It ran more than 700 pages, and it called for sweeping changes to the infrastructure of American cities, to the ways that American institutions interacted with low-income people of color. For instance, they called for the creation of 2 million new jobs and 6 million new units of affordable housing. They wanted to revamp the welfare system. They wanted to eliminate de facto school segregation. They wanted to fundamentally change the way policing was handled, particularly in low-income communities and communities of color. One of the more prescient things that they called for was the diversification of the media, which is a conversation that's still ongoing. And so the conclusions were hard for President Johnson. He knew, politically speaking, that it was just unpalatable, you know, for most white Americans to hear that the problems, as the report said, the problems that faced people in these communities could be laid directly at the doorstep of white America. None of its recommendations were enacted. None of its suggestions ever became legislation or made it off the drafting board, in a sense. It's possible that the Kerner report is even more relevant than it was at the time that it was released. When we look at the questions that arose last summer in the midst of the chaotic and angry protests that filled the streets of dozens, hundreds of American cities after the death of George Floyd, we were fundamentally examining the same questions that Kerner grappled with half a century earlier. And this report was the unheeded warning. I was happy to speak with former Senator Fred Harris about his experience being one of the 11 members on the Kerner Commission. So So you get a call one evening at home from President Lyndon Johnson. Can you tell us a little bit about that call and how the Kerner Commission came to be formed?
Yes, at the height of one of the worst disorders of 1967, soon it was announced that Johnson was going to have a national telecast and appoint the commission. And so we brought a television into our living room and had some neighbors come over just to hear the president. And he called and he said, I'm going to appoint that commission. He actually said, I'm going to appoint that damn commission you've been talking about. That was his exact words. And he said, I'm going to put you on it. He said, let your search be free, find the truth, and express it in your report. And he asked us to answer three questions. What happened in these riots or disorders or violent protests? Secondly, why did it happen? And thirdly, what can we do to keep it from happening again and again? And then he said, I want you to remember that you're a Johnson man. I said, yes, sir, I am a Johnson man. I'm standing up at a wall telephone in my kitchen, and I'm almost saluting. I said, yes, sir, I am a Johnson man.
And what do you think he meant by that?
I don't know exactly, but he didn't want me to go wild and be critical and so forth, I suppose. He then said, if you forget it, I'm going to take my pocket knife and cut your blank off. He did not say blank. He said, you understand that kind of talk, don't you, Fred? And I said, yes, sir. And Johnson later felt I did forget it.
So the commission, once it was staffed, held a series of formal hearings for 20 days.
That's right.
And you interviewed people from Martin Luther King to J. Edgar Hoover.
Right.
Do you recall some of the people who testified and what some of the more notable or memorable testimony was during those hearings?
I do remember Kenneth Clark, as you know, a famous sociologist.
But, psychologist, right. Mm-hmm.
He was a psychologist, as it is. He was very sort of skeptical about the whole thing, and it was a kind of a downer for us. He said, what's this commission going to do? It's just the same old thing keeps happening, and you make these reports, and nothing occurs, nothing happens. That had been the McCone Commission report about the Watts riot of 1965. And a lot of people felt that way, that we don't need more studies. Nothing's going to come out of that commission.
Can you give me a sense of what you think Lyndon Johnson's motives were in creating the commission?
I think they were really sincere. He was deeply committed to do something about racism and poverty in the country. I think these were core commitments of his. He felt very deeply about it. And as we know, he did more against poverty and against racism than any president before or since. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a shame that he wound up, as he did, rejecting the report itself.
We're listening to former Senator Fred Harris talking with Jelani Cobb. More in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
What's fascinating about this is that, the report is, this incredible indictment, of the institutional racism that had factored into, what they kind of politely termed civil disturbances.
Right.
At that time. But, really, it was a preface to even bigger events that would happen, because the report was published just about a month before Martin Luther King died.
Right.
And can you talk to me about, that moment and, what happens in the aftermath of King's assassination? Was there a sense that you all had been kind of shouting into the wilderness?
The way we adopted this report was every word of it was read, was first presented to us, a segment of it in draft form by our excellent staff, headed by the wonderful David Gettysburg, now gone. But that was read aloud with it printed in front of us, and then we voted on. And so when we got to that stage where we said the Negro, as we said in those days, have always known, but white people do not understand, is that white racism caused these black ghettos, and it's white racism that sustains it. Now, there were people on our commission who said, well, they wanted to use words like intolerance or discrimination or whatever. We thought it was important to say racism, and we thought it was important that we say it particularly for black young people. We knew that oppressed people very often come to have the same, believe the same bad stereotypes about themselves that the dominant community does. And we wanted to say to them, you're not crazy. You're in a system that where racism is systematic and is a part of the system. We voted on that. The chair of the commission, Otto Kerner, had taken the position that he would vote only if there was a tie. But he voted with us more progressive members. And by vote, that passed by a vote of 6-5.
Wow. It's interesting because there's this paradox that, the report and its recommendations are ignored by the president who commissioned them, but they are widely and wildly embraced by the public. The report is a New York Times bestseller.
That's right.
Was that response from the public a surprise? And what was the rationale or the thinking behind publishing it and putting out to the public with a trade publisher in the first place? I believe it was Bantam Press that published it.
We were a little worried that this commission, like this report, might just be shelved or even suppressed. And as we approved a segment of the report and voted on it, we sent that segment to Bantam Books, and they were able to put it together in a really heroic effort and bring out the report the very day we released it, on March the 1st, 1968. But the report was leaked, and it was just a mad scramble when it came out, and we tried our best to stop the publication of it by the Washington Post, but they said they had it legally, and all of that caused us a lot of trouble. so that the headlines were "White Racism Cause of Black Riots, Commission Says." And I've said this several times, but my dad, who came from Mississippi, he was a small farmer in those days, 68, southwest Oklahoma. He loved me, of course. He didn't quite understand what I was involved in. But the way he heard that report, he almost used these words, was, "Mr. Harris, out of the goodness of your heart, you ought to pay more taxes to help poor black people who are rioting in Detroit." And my dad literally said, "To hell with that. I'm already paying too much tax and not getting anything out of it." And he was right about that. He did not know that we also said that what we were recommending applied to everybody, white people, black people, and other minorities, American Indians, we said, Hispanic surname, as we said in those days, and other minorities, rural and urban, all of that, we said.
Do you think that was representative, your father's sentiments? Do you think that was representative of how other white people viewed the commission and its recommendations?
I think so. And there was a poll along in that time, even after the Kerner report, when asked a question, do you think that there is something like systematic mistreatment of black people in America? Overwhelming majority of black people said yes, but a majority of white people said no. And it's a shame that our 20 days of hearings were not public hearings. Nobody even thought about it in those days, you know.
Do you have a sense of why Johnson was invested in the idea that there was some sort of subterfuge or conspiracy, you know, whether it was from communists or what they would have called black militants at that time?
Well, I don't know exactly, although a lot of people were saying that. I think Johnson's feelings were hurt in a way. You know, what's the matter with these people? I've given them the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and we've got the poverty program. And here they still cause trouble. Mm-hmm. And you know, he just felt in a way kind of betrayed, I think. And so it must be, you remember there's that old thing they used to call in the South, the happy darky syndrome.
Oh, wow.
You know, mm-hmm. Where white people said, well, I don't know, our black people are happy. You know what?
Sure.
There has to be these outside agitators that are coming in here and stirring them up, like the NAACP and so forth in those days. They, first of all, I said, there are thousands of Stokely Carmichaels and H. Ralph Browns that you and I have never heard of. Mm-hmm. And the conditions in which these people live and the rightful hostility they have toward the police, often the only aspect of the general society that they come in contact with, is such that there's no telling what would happen or how long it would happen.
You know, there have been dozens of these reports now. Certainly the Kerner Commission report is the most comprehensive of them. But it almost constitutes a genre of government document that dates at this point more than a century, these examinations. How do you think we go from diagnosis to actually resolving these issues?
Well, I think we're in the process of doing it. You know, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden got together after it became clear that Biden was going to be the Democratic nominee and worked out what came to be the Democratic platform. And it is by far, I'm a former national chairman of the Democratic Party, it's by far the most progressive platform in the history of the Democratic Party, by far. And public opinion has changed. It's changed in regard to race, And it's changed in regard to what are real solutions to these problems, the kind of conclusions we came to in the Kerner Report. And that's what's made the Kerner Report last. We really did tell the truth. You know, we could have said, well, we do a little of this and a little of that, and maybe things will get better. We knew that wasn't true. And so we decided, we're not going to ask what it'll cost or whether people are going to all agree with it or what. We're going to say what we know is the truth. We have to do really big things and make big, big changes in American society and government. Case after case of these terrible use of force and killings by the police, all of that somehow has brought us to a time where, I mean, the country is split like hell, but the majority of this country, as we saw with Biden's election, now believe that we've got to do big things.
Well, thank you for your time. This has been incredibly insightful, and it's such an honor to get to talk to you today.
Well, thank you. It's the same for me, too, about you.
That's Jelani Cobb speaking with the former senator, Fred Harris. Jelani is co-editor of the Essential Kerner Commission Report, which just came out this year. You can read him on history and racial justice and much more at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and that's our show for today. Thanks so much for joining us. Be well.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.